Well, Oghead, which I've never heard of in my life, that term. Have you?
No.
No, no. So I guess some journalists, when you go see them, anyway, some journalists in San Diego wrote about it and used the term Oghead, so now they're going to... I am the Bob Dylan fan. He's influenced my life. I've had the pleasure to meet him. Okay. I mean, I've had magical moments with Dylan where I didn't actually speak to him, but, you know, I was published in the Sentinel. Why are you almost famous? Well, I did this and this. Ah, that's Bob Dylan's son of that one. You know, and I just tell you that he's a beautiful person, and he's like the Shakespeare of our time. My gosh, there's
he's certainly
literary classes in colleges now that just focus on Dylan, period.
Judith, I'm getting towards the end of my show.
Anyway, it was a good movie.
Another caller.
I recommend the film. I recommend the film because the backdrop is an anarchistic type of society, and it's a lot of food for thought. It's called Chaos and Masked and Anonymous.
Okay, well,
and there's a lot of good lines in there where Dylan says at one time, "Well, there's a lot of money." Oh no, the jailer says, "There's a lot of money in keeping people from having their freedom," and that's one of the first key lines. So well, I recommend it. Thank you.
Okay, Jane,
okay,
thank you.
Okay, bye.
Good evening, caller. You're on the radio. You were on the radio. Well, that was a short, quick, and fast. Well, I started to say all these different things going on, and I'm looking at this business here from Freedom Daily, and I'm just looking at this article, The Rot at the Center of the Empire, and before Judith called, I was talking about what in the world we can do about it all, and so I started to real quickly run down a quick list here, and it's going to be even quicker. I see that we're just up against the clock here. But I think number one is an honest monetary system. I think the IRS should absolutely be abolished. You can have a Bill of Rights or you can have an IRS, but you cannot have both simultaneously. They're mutually exclusive. I think we need to vastly decentralize the federal government. There's just way too much imbalance of concentration of power in the federal government. Again, you get that with this dishonest monetary system. I think... there's great room for voting reform and many ways to have much freer, safer, honest elections than we do. Again, I recommend that article in American Free Press where they describe what has happened to our election system with these computerized voting machines. Well, thank you. I will see you next week.
Oh, how's it going?
Oh,
thank you. Welcome to the Vacation Brothers. Who's doing the program this week?
I haven't heard.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line now from Washington, D.C., the Washington Bureau Chief of World Net Daily, formerly with Investors Business Daily, but Paul Sperry has been writing from Washington, D.C. for a long time. We're going to be talking about his new book, Crude Politics. And it's an excellent book. We'll be carrying that here at Radio Liberty. Paul, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, of course, your book is fascinating. It goes into, of course, crude politics. It's not the politics of crude, but the politics really of crude oil and natural gas. And really, of course, so much of the what we read in the newspaper about why we went to war with Afghanistan and why we went to war with Iraq really has to be looked at in the specter of course, the oil that was there and the decisions that were made long before either the 9/11 attack or the so-called threat of weapons of mass destruction. Would that be a fair statement?
That's right. To make any sense of the administration's war strategy, you have to follow the oil. It really is that simple, although how they've gone about it is quite complicated, as I detail in Crude Politics. The political and corporate connections alone are fascinating.
And, of course, they talk here about the fact that here we go to war with Afghanistan to capture Osama bin Laden, and then we just sort of forget all about Osama bin Laden. We forget all about al-Qaeda, and we go to war with Iraq, and yet, of course, instead of finishing the job and stopping this worldwide terrorist movement, we move into Iraq, which only flares up this whole worldwide terrorist movement.
That's right. We lost Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan because of preoccupation with regime change, and we gave new life to Osama bin Laden because of regime change in Iraq. And one is linked to the other, but both have connections in terms of removing U.N. sanctions on oil investment in the Caspian region and also in Iraq. Something that, as you mentioned before, that this was plans that were dusted off by this administration after the attacks. I'm not arguing at all that this administration knew the attacks were coming or provoked the attacks to open up oil frontiers or anything like that, but they seized on it as a golden opportunity to dust off these plans and open up these frontiers for not just the country, these new oil frontiers, but also for their former clients, board members, and donors. A lot of the war principles that helped craft the war strategy after September 11th were former Washington lobbyists for oil concerns that have big stakes in both the Caspian region and in Iraq. And as you already know, the president and vice president, of course, have connections to the oil patch, heading former oil companies, and a number of the other folks who were around that table in the Situation Room.
You're talking about the Armitage and, of course, Condoleezza Rice. And
the Armitage was a lobbyist, and Gandhi Rice was a board member for 10 years at Chevron Texaco. And even landed an oil tanker after, but she was an expert on Caspian politics for them on that board. And it's a lot more involved than Halliburton and Dick Cheney and all that.
And of course, you talk about Senator Sam Brownback and his relationship to this whole consortium that wanted to run the pipelines through that area. Really, the pipelines are sort of the key to understanding everything, aren't they?
It sure is. Interestingly, the plan, the Afghan plan that was dusted off was, the architect of that was a fellow by the name of Zalmay Khalilzad, and he's in the National Security Council right under Condoleezza Rice, and the White House was very instrumental in the initial war strategy. Now he's brokering regime change behind the scenes, behind this pro-consul consul Walt Bremer in Baghdad. Now, well, his original plan in Afghanistan for toppling the Taliban before the 9/11 attacks was centered around paving and clearing the way for a, as he called it, a valuable energy corridor. And this involved these two pipelines, initially just two, the Crown had more crude oil and gas. The gas one is on the fast track. It's already, the memorandum, the agreement has already been signed on that. And right after the attacks, and 2 days after we started bombing Afghanistan, President Bush dispatched his ambassador to Pakistan. These pipelines have to go through Afghanistan and Pakistan to get out to these hot Asian markets that the Caspian investors in the U.S. have desired to export that crude and gas out of there. Much more profitable markets there, and the shortest and cheapest route to those markets is through Afghanistan and Pakistan. But before the war, that both the Taliban and the Pakistani regime that backed the Taliban had been blocking them. But now they're right at it. Now they're fully on board, and 2 days after we started bombing Afghanistan, we were all still reeling from the 9/11 attacks. Bush had his ambassador to Pakistan sit down and meet with Pakistan's oil minister, and they talked about the pipelines. And
you mean when they were still digging the victims out of the rubble of 9/11, while our ambassador, while our people were over there negotiating to get those pipelines through?
Yes, sir. And the dust had not even settled at Ground Zero yet, and they were already. This was their behind the scenes hidden agenda they were working out. And by the way, the president personally got involved in these pipelines last year, working with Musharraf and Hamid Karzai meeting on them in New York. So it's not like the president was out of the loop and he just had some of his diplomats and officials working independently of his knowledge. No, that he was directly involved in this. And then you mentioned Senator Brownback. Now, he's key because a number of sanctions were lifted on these countries, countries that have been on the wish list of a number of Bush-Cheney oil donors. He was instrumental in helping lift these sanctions quietly, all in the name of fighting the war on terrorism. 2 weeks after the Bush's ambassador to Pakistan meets with the oil minister over there in Pakistan, Senator Brownback starts the Silk Road Caucus on Capitol Hill. This is still as we're all, thinking that the folks in Washington are worried about bringing up bin Laden to justice and securing this nation. Well, there's a commercial front that's opening up big time.
Our compassion about the victims, and within 48 hours of the attack, while we were over there negotiating how we were going to be able to get these pipelines down across Afghanistan, across Pakistan, they seemed to be in a real hurry to accomplish this goal, weren't they?
Well, yeah. 2 weeks after the secret meeting over there with the oil minister, then Brownback starts the Silk Road Caucus to initiate all this legislation that they've been seeking. And then as soon as the Taliban was toppled, Musharraf and Hamid Karzai, who Khalilzad installed, groomed and installed, this guy was preordained before, long before. He also worked on these pipelines with Khalilzad in the 90s.
You're
here in Washington.
Who became the president or whatever
yes,
it is.
That's right.
The democratically elected, they've never had an election to put this guy. We installed a dictator there, and then we wonder why the people are resentful.
Well, a number of the delegates, as I documented in Crude Politics, were very resentful because they felt that the U.S. was led by Khalilzad, the emissary for all this regime change. This Washington insider goes way back to the first Bush administration. He's another old Bush hand. They accused him of rigging the election, pushing out the former king and another competitor for the job to get Hamid Karzai in. But they knew that he would immediately sign the deal for the pipelines with Musharraf, which they did. I mean, they came through, and Musharraf has been bought off. He's been given $2 billion in aid and also promised another $3 billion and had sanctions lifted on his regime for U.S. investment in Pakistan. And then you also have the specter of Rich Armitage over at the State Department, this former Caspian lobbyist who was the president of the U.S. Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, also getting involved in this. He working with, once again, Brownback, had U.S. sanctions on Azerbaijan, a major producer in the Caspian, quietly lifted, again in the name of the war on terrorism. And then he went back to, as I documented in the book, went back to his chamber, U.S. Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, a big lobbyist, powerful lobbyist here. Cheney's been on it. A number of these guys that all show up on this lobbying group, and gloated about how he had lifted the administration had lifted these sanctions they couldn't get lifted under the Clinton administration on Azerbaijan to open up investment in that huge gas producing country. And now we've got UN sanctions lifted on Iraq, which has also been on the wish list of a number of Bush Cheney donors, and including very specifically Condoleezza Rice's former employer.
You mean that 7 years ago?
Yes, I quote the former CEO saying they couldn't wait to get their hands on the oil there. And the reason that Iraqi oil is so prized is because there's not only a lot of it, Stan. There's it's very cheap to produce. In fact, it's half as much to produce per barrel on average than even in Saudi. That's only $2 a barrel. In Iraq, it's only $1 a barrel on average to get it. It's very shallow. You don't have to drill far to get a gusher. And by comparison, the U.S., it's about $10 a barrel on average production cost. So it's 10 times cheaper in Iraq. And then also on top of that, it's sweet crude. About as sweet as Libya's crude. It's highly sought because it's much cheaper to refine. It's got a low sulfur content. It's Saudi right next door is a sour crude. It's not as desirable. So Iraq is, boy, that's the holy grail in terms of the oil and gas industry. And in comparison, the Caspian is $3 a barrel. So it's still a lot cheaper than the U.S., but Iraq's even cheaper to drill. So they've been licking their chops, they've been chomping at the bit, to get their hands on, to privatize that oil and get back in there after they've been blocked by the sanctions since the first Gulf War.
Well, first of all, how did Karzai come to be the president of Afghanistan? Was it really an open election where everybody had a chance to vote, or how did he end up as the president?
Well, there was a lot of back behind the scenes arm twisting by Khalilzad. They said it was as best as you can do, democratically held election in terms of the delegates voting that they put over there. But what they did was a lot of maneuvering, shall we say. Zalmay Khalilzad, as the president calls him, Zal, not exactly a household name, but he's not even really a household name here in Washington, as I've discovered, as I've investigated him and followed his footprints throughout all this, footprints going back to the 80s, in fact. He's been tied up with the same group. In fact, he goes back to Osama bin Laden, helping arm Osama bin Laden with Stinger missiles in the campaign to drive out the Soviet, during Soviet occupation. It was Zalmay Khalilzad who suggested that we get Osama bin Laden Stinger missiles, and that really turned the tide against the Soviets. But I digress. I'm just saying that this guy goes way back with the Bush cronies.
He's extremely influential,
even though he's not a household name, is my point. And, he doesn't get a single mention, believe it or not, in Bob Woodward's book. I believe it's called Bush at War.
Right.
360-page tome. And yet even in the index, you will not find Zalmay Khalilzad. It's just amazing. But readers will become well acquainted with Mr. Khalilzad and crude politics, my book.
Well, I certainly appreciate your book. Well, anyway, who appointed the delegates who elected Karzai? Do we appoint the delegates who elected the man that we wanted?
Exactly. I mean, it was a fait accompli that Hamid Karzai would be the interim president. behind the scenes. It was called a Loya Yurga, is the name of the procedure that they had. Assembly over there, and it was Khalilzad, who I quote a number of delegates who observed what was happening. They were very upset that of the arm twisting. They even had the Loya Yurga delayed several days so that he could work on pushing the king out of the picture and getting Hami Karzai in there. It's also interesting to note that during the initial campaign in Afghanistan, the military campaign, the Pentagon was flying Hami Karzai in and out. You see, he was in Pakistan at the time, exiled. He used to work for the Taliban, but then grew to discuss it with their hardline Islamic take, their Sharia law. But initially, he supported them. He was actually an official in the Taliban regime initially in the mid-90s, and then left Afghanistan with the Pakistan. We were flying him in and out of Afghanistan, supporting this guy, and really grooming him to take over before there was any toppling of the Taliban, and the dust had settled, and we were trying to organize a Loya Yurga or some kind of democratic assembly to democratically elect somebody. Put somebody in there to replace the Taliban regime. I mean, we were working on this guy long before that, and then before that, I looked at INS records on Hami Karzai, how many times he'd entered the U.S. because the story that was told to the press when Hami Karzai, this was the fellow who came with the green robe and everything and sat next to the First Lady at the State of the Union. Remember that last year?
Right.
It was, as I described, as kind of like a Disney movie where here's this lowly tribal warrior who came out of obscurity and comes back to his homeland and takes over the government. He's living in a palace or whatever now. It wasn't like that at all. This guy, he's been in Washington many, many times, according to INS records and people I talked to working on the pipeline back in the 90s to get it through. And get the sanctions removed on the Taliban. He was working alongside these folks and bringing people in here for State Department visits and back and forth. So
was he actually working for UNICAL?
Yes, he was. He actually worked for UNICAL. And so did UNICAL, was the original leader of the consortium. And they're using UNICAL's model now for the gas pipeline. By the way, the Khalilzad was consulted for UNICAL as well at the same time.
All right, we're going to just have to take a quick break here, and we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest. His name is Paul Sperry. His book, of course, is Crude Politics. He's the senior editor for Gronet Daily in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back with Paul Sperry. All right, well, our guest is Paul Sperry, and of course we're talking about his book, Crude Politics. And let's just go back to the oil in the Caspian Sea Basin, which is, of course, the subject of this. And, of course, as Paul brings out in his book, the Caspian Sea is a body of water about the size of the state of California. So it's long and elongated. It's pretty good size. How much oil are we talking about? I mean, are we talking about, you compare this to the oil in the Alaska Reserve, and then, of course, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. Do we know how much oil is there?
Actually, we don't. We think there's trillions of dollars, enough deposits that would rival, is at least enough that have been found in Alaska and the North Sea, but possibly rivaling Saudi Arabia, which has the largest proven reserves. By the way, Iraq is second in terms of proven reserves. So we don't know. It could be more because there hasn't been a whole heck of a lot of exploration there. The Caspian, the key to the Caspian is exporting the reserves out of there once you get them out of the ground, because the Caspian is landlocked, surrounded by all the land, all the Ikistan, Russia to the north, and then all the Ikistans, as I call them, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. You've got also Iran. You've got Afghanistan to the south and Pakistan. And the problem has always been the pipeline export routes have always gone east to west, predominantly and controlled by Russia. And they've got some new pipelines in there that some consortia have built and are in the process of building, but they still go out to the Mediterranean, ultimately. And that the markets to the west there are growing as fast as in Asia, and that's where they want to really get this energy reserves too. And if you go out the Mediterranean, you've got to come down the Red Sea and out to the Arabian Sea, to the Indian Ocean, out over to Asia, and it's just cost prohibitive. So the producers there, these U.S. investors and, you know, also European investors there in the Caspian, the big goal has been to come up with some cheaper, shorter routes to Asia, and that the cheapest and shortest route is directly through Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of course, you go through Iran, but the sanctions there are prohibited for U.S. investors. And now that's possible, the way has been cleared, and thanks to regime change and. This is the most profitable route to export that crude. The problem is that while we were focusing on regime change and lifting these sanctions, and by the way, this was a dual strategy. The administration wanted to get Bin Laden, still does. They also wanted to figure this was a golden opportunity to open up these oil frontiers, remove these sanctions, and get these deals through finally. The problem is they've really only gotten the deals on track. You know, the manhunt for Bin Laden is still on the slow track. He slipped out the back door while we were focusing on the Northern Alliance and the north of Afghanistan. We had a rare beat on Osama Bin Laden in the fall of 2001. When he was still using his satellite phone.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest. But right now, we'll have to rejoin our network. And there we are. So let's get right back on. And so you said we had a bead on Bin Laden. He was using a satellite telephone. We knew exactly where he was because of that, and we didn't take him out.
Yeah, because and this was something that was very, I really... I voted for Bush, and I was all on board. I thought the counterstrikes in Afghanistan were morally justified. But what I couldn't understand was what my military terror sources kept telling me, especially folks who had been in the special ops forces who had done tours over there, were coming back and telling me things that they said that they were told to take a back seat to local Afghan proxy fighters and just basically they're painting targets, as they called it, basically calling in bombing coordinates while these folks actually hunted down Bin Laden in the caves and everything up in the White Mountains. And meanwhile, our forces were focused primarily, from the air, softening Taliban targets in the north for the Northern Alliance to come in and storm Kabul. And we really... It was like an afterthought, getting Bin Laden in terms of the strategy. And my military sources, both in the Pentagon, too, but just couldn't, in CENTCOM, they couldn't figure out why we didn't have a narrowly targeted or narrowly defined mission to decapitate the Al-Qaeda leadership. You know, go in there, seal off those export, or those escape routes to Pakistan, and then come in, close in, and strangle Bin Laden and his crew that were there. We knew where they were. And instead, by the time we started bombing Tora Bora, and we still didn't go in with our guys with boots on the ground, the local Afghan proxy fighters that we trusted, they betrayed us and helped us escort Bin Laden, his wives, and some of the other Al-Qaeda leaders across the border into Pakistan, where right now they still have sanctuary. It's been confirmed that what I've said in the book now, that see Bin Laden and the top lieutenants there hiding out in the Pashtun tribal belt of Pakistan. They had relative sanctuary and refuge there because the Pakistan, we've relied on the Pakistani military now, this administration, to hunt him down. So we really haven't learned the lessons. In the first case, we were betrayed, the Afghan, we farmed out the war, the fighting of the manhunt for Bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders to local Afghan Muslims. Now this administration is farming out our war once again to Pakistani Muslims who revere Bin Laden. You know, this is the guy that helped train and finance the jihadi fighters in Kashmir. Kashmir, taking over Kashmir all of Kashmir from India, is number one on the agenda, both domestic and foreign, for Pakistan. And, you know, they'll be damned if they're going to go in there and ferret out Bin Laden. They respect this guy.
But Paul, it doesn't make any sense. You know, first of all, we really don't try to get him when he is, we know where he is, and we send in the Northern Alliance. And now, of course, we're letting the Pakistan do it, and we know they're not doing it. It doesn't seem like we're really trying to get Bin Laden. This is what's so infuriating.
It is. It's incredibly frustrating. This administration, this President Bush, has agreed to a very strange arrangement with Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, whereby our troops who are based in Afghanistan cannot step one foot across the border into Pakistan, even if they're attacked by marauding al-Qaeda fighters who are based in Pakistan, coming across the border, which they're doing a lot. In fact, we've just got a number of commandos who just were reported dead in such an attack. They can't, even when they're attacked, go back and do a search of just cross the border, do a search and destroy mission at those al-Qaeda camps on the Pakistani side of the border. And the administration has said that, well, you know, we can't upset the Islamic people in Pakistan. They might revolt against Musharraf. These are, you know, our frontline ally in the war on terrorism. But wait a minute. We had five bases in Pakistan. They go into Afghanistan to do the bombing missions for regime change, and no one complained in Pakistan. The citizenry, they knew all about those bases. We were actually based in Pakistan. Now we can't come across and step one foot when it comes to hunting down Bin Laden. That's very strange. But the key is keeping Musharraf on board the pipelines. That's the key. And there's a feasibility study coming this month on that. And once that's done, it'll be off to the races in terms of opening up, starting the consortium and opening up the bidding from investors.
Well, I find it, of course, one of the points that Paul makes in his book very well is the fact that as long as the Taliban was in power, international finance would not lend money. They wanted a stable society. They did not feel the Taliban was stable. Big banks were not going to lend money. They had to get rid of the Taliban some way. And we'll be covering that in just a moment here as we come back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Paul Sperry, and of course he is the Washington Bureau Chief for WorldNetDaily.com. And if you don't read WorldNetDaily.com, shame on you. It's a publication of our good friend Jill Farah doing a great job. You'll get the information there that the ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN doesn't want you to get. And let me just strongly recommend that you get yourself a computer, even though you maybe you consider yourself computer illiterate. You need to have one, first of all, so you can read WorldNetDaily every day. Secondly, so you can go to my website and listen to Radio Liberty 5 hours a day. And at least we'll keep you abreast of what's really going on, because these are the most important and significant times, really, in all history. I think that the things that are unfolding now will influence what happens in the world for generations to come. Assuming that there are generations to come, that is. Under any circumstances, we were just talking about how the administration really isn't trying to get Osama bin Laden, because, of course, the major thrust is getting these pipelines through. It was the major thrust 2 days after the attack on the World Trade Center, and it has always been the major thrust getting these pipelines through. And of course, the international financiers, the bankers, said, "We will not invest when the Taliban is there." Was that a pretty fair statement?
Yeah, and it's important to point out that the Taliban, actually, they did not attack us. Now, they did harbor Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and in doing so, they met properly with the fate of under the Bush doctrine. But it was really it's Al-Qaeda that attacked us, and what a lot of folks in the military, even at CENTCOM, were expecting that we would narrowly target Bin Laden and actually take them out, decapitate them. Instead, we just scattered them while focusing on the Taliban regime change. And then we've done the same thing in Iraq, but it's even worse because we've now discovered that there's no credible evidence, and the administration had no credible evidence going in. Saddam Hussein had a formal alliance with Al-Qaeda. They definitely did not have, you know, evidence that Saddam Hussein was behind or sponsored the 9/11 attacks or any attack on U.S. territory. That's right in the National Intelligence Estimate that was recently declassified. So something that's interesting is that there's a parallel here with this fellow Khalilzad. He's really the protagonist of my book. His ally, Khalilzad, had a plan for regime change before before September 11th in Baghdad as well as Kabul. And he was testifying before Brownback's committee, Senator Brownback, back on how to overthrow Saddam Hussein with none other than Ahmad Chalabi, who's the Pentagon's golden boy for replacing Saddam Hussein. He's over there now as acting president of this governing council. He's been successfully groomed behind the scenes by Khalilzad, Bush's special envoy to Baghdad, and was even flown in during the war by the Pentagon, just like Hamid Karzai. Chalabi was flown into Baghdad during the war. I mean, this was preordained. This is the guy they want. Well, this is what's interesting by half as well, is that this fellow, just like Hamid Karzai, has ties to the oil industry. His uncle was a deputy minister in the oil ministry in Iraq, and he has argued for privatizing the Iraqi National Oil Company to open up the oil fields to outside investment, particularly the U.S., of course.
You think that might just play some little tiny part in the fact that he's the man we're pushing to lead the country? Because the people certainly don't want him. He does, as far as I can tell, he has no constituency at all.
No, they don't have much. He has almost zero respect among the people there, and he's got all sorts of influence in Washington, particularly with this administration. This has been their guy going back. He testified before Brownback's committee with alongside Khalilzad. On how to overthrow Saddam Hussein just 5 years ago in 2000 before Vice President Cheney was nominated as picked as Vice President. He was still head of Halliburton, the oil field services company. He was meeting with Cheney, this guy Chalabi, and now Halliburton has this nearly $2 billion contract. No competitive bid contract, by the way. It was actually awarded before we ever invaded Iraq, also, interestingly enough.
People give incest a bad name.
Yeah, I mean, this is not capitalism, but for, you know, Republicans who are free market conservatives, this is not capitalism. These are not capitalists. This is crony capitalism, and these are crony capitalists. They suck from the bosom of big government to get getting these fat contracts rather than actually, coming up with new ideas and inventions in the marketplace. They make their profits, by a collusion between big government and big industry. And taxpayers pay for these contracts. And oh, by the way, I just got word from some of my sources that that about a quarter of this $87 billion that the President has asked Congress for, additionally, for reconstruction in Iraq, about a quarter of that is earmarked for these big contracts, for more of these contracts. So they're going to...
A quarter, that's what you're talking over, John.
About $21 billion, I'm told, is going to go for more of these contracts to, you know, that will end up going to big Bush donors. So they're going to clean up, but it's taxpayers. You and I, who are paying for this, we're picking up the tab for this war profiteering. And what's worse is young soldiers, these young kids who have their whole lives ahead of them, are paying with their lives, are being picked off every day now. We had another soldier killed today in an ambush. And, you know, that's inexcusable, using these kids as pawns and, you know, exploiting the commercial front in this war, this particular part of the war. It turns out there was no weapons of mass destruction. There was no credible evidence that Saddam Hussein either had anything to do with 9/11 or any terrorist act in the U.S. And never had a formal alliance with Al-Qaeda, we're now discovering. So there was really no imminent threat, as the President posited, and claimed going in. So this thing was a complete non sequitur. In the middle of a war in Al-Qaeda, we went into Iraq for really no good reason, and we were sold a bill of goods, American people. And the media in general should be ashamed for being so pliant and not asking questions and not being skeptical, because skepticism is the number one tool of free press and journalists. We're not the sharpest knives in the drawer. We're generalists. We're not experts. But one thing we have is skepticism, and we abandon that skepticism because of this patriotic fervor, you know, everybody was burying their heads in the flag, and you had the Fox model, Fox News model, and talk radio, like Rush Limbaugh and Hannity, doing the President's bidding on Iraq and not asking any questions, and everybody really kind of just went along, were intimidated, I guess, and didn't ask any questions, and now, you know, we ended up with the President took us into a situation where, you know, he's really got us in a pickle over there. And these, like I said, these young kids are just, you know, they're paying with their lives for this stuff. And that really is inexcusable. What's even more troubling is that we've diverted resources from the hunt for bin Laden. All the while we've been focused on Iraq. Resources that we've diverted in the form of troops, intelligence assets, Arabic translators, which are key to gathering human intelligence to hunt down, find bin Laden. And Dr. Zawahiri is number two guy. He's his spiritual advisor and tactical advisor too. A lot of people don't know that he's his tactical advisor. We got to get him too. And not to mention money. You know, with the President's coming begging for another $87 billion, that's just the start of it. That's just going to preliminary stuff. Reconstruction. There's going to be hundreds of billions dollar more that we're going to have to spend in Iraq. And it turns out it had nothing to do really with the war on terrorism and protecting America. Now, it probably had something to do with protecting Israel in terms of Saddam Hussein financing those suicide bombers, Palestinian suicide bombers. He gave something like $32 million the families of those suicide bombers. They wanted to, Tel Aviv wanted to try that up and also prevent any chance of him using Scuds. But now we've even found that he didn't even have the Scuds that we were told by this administration that he had. We can't find that either.
Has Saudi Arabia been giving money to the terrorist bombers too?
Exactly. And that brings up the whole question of why in the world is this administration coddling, some would say covering, for the Saudi regime. If anybody was up for regime change, good reason for regime change, it was the kingdom, the royal family there, who we've been finding out has been financing Al-Qaeda, who actually attacked us, not to mention the Palestinian families of those suicide bombers, the Palestinian conflict. You know, that's a very good question. Why regime change in Iraq, but not regime change in Riyadh? Well, the what goes a long way to explaining that is this administration, this White House, or particularly the Bush family, this president has an unprecedented cozy relationship with the Saudi royal family. Presidents going way back have had close association with the Saudi regime and the monarchy, but no one has had such personal ties in not just that, but financial and business commercial ties through his father, and Bush himself too, his former partner, was tied to the former president of the Saudi National Bank in terms of representing his interests in the U.S. This was down in Texas. But the main reason that Bush continues to cover for the Saudis is, the reason he allowed Osama bin Laden's relatives to be whisked out of the country after 9/11. It's the same reason he won't declassify those 28 pages on Saudi in the 9/11 report. And that's his old family friend, Saudi Prince Bandar, or Bandar Bush, as he's fondly known within the Bush clan when he said this kind of bunk port. And by the way, about 2 weeks ago, the former President Bush, his father, met with Bandar, had lunch with him in Kennebunkport, and then he was shuttled right after that down to Wyoming to meet with Vice President Cheney. We don't know what they talked about, but we can assume it was about the latest revelations coming out of the leaks from this report that the president has blacked out 28 pages, and even Republicans on the Hill urging him, come on, release this to the public, and he won't do it. Well, but anyway, Bandar and the Bushes go way back, and it was Bandar who lobbied the White House to spirit the bin Laden out of the country. It's pointed out in Chapter 6 of my book, it's now been confirmed by a former Bush White House official, that the White House authorized that just within days of the attack.
And this is when, of course, regular commercial planes weren't allowed to fly, but of course they could fly these big airliners to pick up the bin Laden family and get them out of the country.
Well, there's some dispute as to whether or not there was still the no-fly restrictions when they were taken out, but it was within 10 days after the attacks. And what's alarming is that the FBI was not allowed to interrogate these relatives. And there was another 100 Saudis that we don't know who these people were that were also allowed to leave without any questioning or hard interrogation by the FBI. But it's inexcusable that 24 relatives of bin Laden himself would be allowed to go, because on September 11th, I filed a story talking to my Pentagon sources. They were already picking targets to retaliate against bin Laden in Afghanistan. They knew it was bin Laden. And then these bin Laden relatives were allowed to, over the course of the next week and a half, leave the country without any questioning. But it was Bandar who this was done at the behest of Bandar, who's the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. He lives here in McLean. It's a suburb of Washington. It's a very affluent suburb. He lives in this leafy part of McLean near Great Falls in this mansion. And it is also Bandar and his wife, Princess Haifa, whose brother, by the way, is the former Saudi intelligence chief who for years protected bin Laden, who were cited in the 9/11 report as possible co-conspirators, being the paymasters, in fact, at least indirectly, not directly. They say they didn't know the money was going to hijacking operation, but over $100,000 went to these hijackers, sponsoring them once they came in the country. They were from Saudi. These were the Saudi hijackers who took the plane into the Pentagon. They're claiming ignorance, and we didn't know what they said. Yeah, our money went to friends of theirs. We didn't know they were going to distribute it to actual hijackers. But that's what the FBI needs to continue to investigate. And they may already have more solid links than we know in those 28 pages, and they haven't revealed them. The president refuses to let the American people see Saudi's involvement in this. But then you also, that's the personal side of it, Bandar Bush and the Bushes. And by the way, Barbara Bush is pals with Princess Haifa, and she's been up to Kennebunkport for her birthday party, and President Bush has gone over and gone hunting over in Spain on his he actually flown on his jet with Bandar Bush, Prince Bandar, but also there's a commercial and financial link here and a reason behind this, covering for the Saudis. Bush's father and his old pal James Baker III, former Secretary of State, the lawyer who helped Bush with his Florida election crisis, personally has done business with the Bin Laden family right up to the day of the 9/11 attacks. A lot of people don't know this, but on September 10th and September 11th, 2001, former President Bush, James Baker III, and representatives of the Bin Laden family, including the brother of Bin Laden's own brother, were meeting at the Ritz-Carlton here in Washington, talking about business as part of the Carlyle Group, this big investment house here that Bush's father, the principal and an investor and a representative, same with James Baker, he's the counsel for the Carlyle Group. But they personally have done business with the Bin Laden family. And Baker's law firm, get this, this is down in Houston, Baker and Botts, where I used to live. I know it well. Baker and Botts is now defending, believe it or not, defending the Saudi defense minister against the $1 trillion lawsuit brought by the families of 9/11 victims. And in crude politics, I produced a high-level secret letter between a top Bush administration official and a Saudi official that reveals the alarming degree of access and the clout that the royal family has with this administration. And it's just become painfully obvious to me that our commander-in-chief has a serious conflict of interest in effectively prosecuting this war in Al-Qaeda because of his ties, close ties to the Saudis. And we now know that the Saudis have been backing Al-Qaeda and playing a double game with us. So that's very disturbing, this conflict of interest.
All right, well, I wanted to cover another couple of things. You mentioned in your book General that's a pretty close pronunciation of his name. He was the chief of Saudi intelligence?
Yes, indeed.
All right, now, there have been reports that out of India that he had actually sent $100,000 to the Muhammad Ali. Have you ever heard that or checked that out at all?
Yeah, I did, and I got that from a number of first of all, as I quoted here, there's a couple of sources I have in the Senate who received a classified briefing from this Fernandez, the defense minister in India, right after the attacks. In fact, the Indians were all gung-ho they thought we were going to target Pakistan. They knew from their intelligence that was the epicenter of the anti-American center, and they were the link with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And they were ready to go with us militarily and do a joint operation, and we said, no thanks. And they presented all this intelligence to us, including the financial link.
Between Ahmed and, of course, the financing Muhammad Ali.
Right. And it's very disturbing. And now we have a Defense Intelligence Agency documents that were released today through a FOIA. This was back in the fall of 2001. These documents were written that show that Pakistan indeed did back the Al-Qaeda. And specifically what the documents are talking about, they refer to these terrorist camps, these Al-Qaeda terrorist camps in Afghanistan. Well, the ISI, which is the intelligence arm of the Pakistani military, and they basically run the country. I mean, this is a military coup that Musharraf undertook in 1999. The ISI is basically the state within the state.
Is it like the CIA here?
No, the CIA, if you believe the CIA runs this country and it has all these clandestine operations around the world and they're that powerful, then yeah, you could say that they're like that, but this is much more, I would argue, ISI is much more powerful and even less clandestine than the CIA. Everybody knows that the ISI runs Pakistan. They're Islamic fundamentalists.
It ties between the CIA and ISI.
Yes, back in the 80s, in fact, the CIA got involved in working with the ISI directly to build up what later became Al-Qaeda, but they had a common goal to drive out the communists. And unfortunately, they, as soon as the communists were driven out back to the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, we didn't have a contingency. We didn't. It created this vacuum, this power vacuum in Afghanistan. It was filled by these nuts, which eventually, you know, they had a civil war after civil war, eventually led to the Taliban. And interestingly enough, the former top aide on Senator Sam Brownback's Foreign Relations Subcommittee is a woman by the name of Christina Rocca, and you'll find her throughout my book as well. She worked for the CIA previously. She's now in the Bush White House. She went from the CIA, and she went to the Hill. She worked for Brownback, and she set up the, she invited all these, you know, Khalil Zod and all these, Tommy Karzai and all these folks to testify before his committee and do all this lobbying. And when the Bush administration came in, lo and behold, she ends up in the State Department as the point person for all policy matters related to Pakistan and Afghanistan. And she's the one who's helped, she's kind of the bridge between the administration and the executive branch and Capitol Hill in getting through these, getting these sanctions listed on Pakistan and Azerbaijan and Afghanistan. And when she was at the CIA during the 80s, she worked alongside with Khalilzad, Salmay Khalilzad, in helping the Mujahideen and bin Laden, who were helping arm them with the Stinger missiles and all this stuff. So it goes full circle, you see. It's amazing, the interconnectedness of all these old Bush hands in this administration, their common interest. They all have a common interest in the oil patch. And this was the 9/11 provided the pretext to get all this stuff done that has been on their wish list.
And, of course, you mentioned lifting the sanctions on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, of course, that was really absolutely essential if we were going to get the international financing for the pipelines. Wasn't that the significance of lifting those sanctions?
That is exactly right. Look, these things are multi-billion-dollar projects. They'd never get off the ground without international financing. You know, even though you have multi-billion-dollar corporations, they don't have the cash flow to finance stuff like this. And no, quite frankly, no individual bank, private commercial lender is going to lend money on such huge projects, especially in untried countries like that. You know, third world countries, it's just too risky. So the only way you can get the money, the backing, the financing, is through international lenders, such as the World Bank, or in this case, it looks like they're going to get a combination of money from World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, which is doing the feasibility study. But our own OPIC, Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and the Export-Import Bank here, these are both federally operated lenders, they've already gotten involved in opening the purse strings for Pakistan, Afghanistan, Azerbaijan. So they're busy, man. I mean, this is why I wrote this book, is so that Americans, to let Americans see what the president and his war advisors have been doing behind the scenes of the war. While they said they had Al-Qaeda on the run and we're hunting them down one by one, and, you know, these evildoers, and we're asking for your patience and patience, and getting the kingpin, bin Laden. What they were doing was busying themselves with a lot of oil deal-making and war profiteering and sanctions lifting and international financing for their former clients, board members, and donors, and all the while saying it's in the name of fighting terrorism. But this was all been... this has all been quietly done and very behind the scenes. And the president's been very good at going out in public and also on the carrier and everything and coming out with this really tough sounding rhetoric. And, you know, the image, quite frankly, is the one that, when that he conveys is that he's working 24/7 on protecting us. And, well, they've also been protecting their own commercial interests, as we see and as I expose in this book, Crude Politics.
Let me just comment that, of course, the book is Crude Politics. It's written by Paul Sperry. And if you'd like to know more about the book, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. This is an excellent, excellent book, and that's why we're going to carry it at Radio Liberty, because I really think that if you want to know what's going on, you need to read this book. It gives you an entirely different perspective. Well, Paul, I could go on another hour, but I know it's almost midnight back there, the witching hour. I hope, though, that we will be doing another interview with you, I think, later this week, and I hope we can call on you from time to time. You're a fascinating individual and a great source of information.
Well, you're too kind. Thank you so much.
All right, well, fine. Well, of course, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be talking to you later this week.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Paul Sperry, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with him. And, of course, the book, Crude Politics, and remember, if you want to get it, just 1-800-544-8927 will tell you how you can go about getting the book. And then we hope, of course, many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day as we reach out across America, bringing you the information you're not going to get from ABC, CBS, and NBC, or CNN, or Fox News, or any of the controlled establishment news outlets, because they control both the conservative and the liberal news. And do not think for 1 minute Fox is conservative, although they'll try to tell you that. Don't you believe it. Under any circumstances, if you are interested in becoming part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters to see what they're like, give us a call. And until tomorrow, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because behind everything going on, there is a spiritual battle. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Lord will be with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we're going to do something a little unusual. We're going to have an open line time. I'm going to talk to you about the similarity between Pearl Harbor and 911, but we'll welcome your calls if you're out there. And Chris, if you'd like to give us a call, you know our numbers, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I just wanted to, Chris, go into a little bit of the background of what's going on today. We've lost almost 300 American servicemen in the war in Iraq since it began. We've lost over 1,000 American casualties. Many of the young men have lost arms and legs and hands and eyes. Between 5 and 10,000 Iraqis are dead. Tens of thousands of Iraqis are citizens and soldiers have been wounded. The Bush administration claims we had to attack Saddam Hussein because he had weapons of mass destruction, but then Russia has weapons of mass destruction, so does China, and they both helped finance the Islamic terror. So does certainly Pakistan. It has weapons of mass destruction, and Iran has weapons of mass destruction, and they've backed the terrorists. Even some of the Cuban immigrants say that Fidel Castro has weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical weapons. Should we go to war with those people? It'd be a lot easier to go to war with Fidel Castro. He's just 90 miles off the Florida Keys. Well, what's this really all about? What was 9/11 really all about? And perhaps to understand what this is really all about, why I need to, of course, to take you back sometime. Let me take you back to the time of the Pearl Harbor. Because you have to understand Pearl Harbor because you can understand what's going on in the United States today. And if you, of course, I had the opportunity some years ago to go through the records at the Sterling Library at Yale University where Henry Stimson's diary is. Henry Stimson was the Secretary of War in 1941. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was very, very close to the Bundy family. And you remember his name, George Bundy, who was the National Security Advisor and a member of Skull and Bones. In fact, Henry Stimson was a member of Skull and Bones, as I remember. They were both bonesmen, and they were, of course, both members of the Council on Foreign Relations. But Nick George Bundy was the man who got us into Vietnam. He was the National Security Advisor and to both President Kennedy and President Johnson. In fact, Henry Stimson and Nick George Bundy wrote a book together. It was called On Watch. And, of course, these are the men who took us into the First World War and into the Vietnam War. But Henry Stimson's diary, page 48 and 49, as I remember, it has this notation in it, and it basically says that, well, we were called to the White House, and we were there for an hour and a half, and there at the meeting were Hull, Knox, Marshall, and myself, and, of course, the President of the United States. Now, Hull, the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull was the Secretary of State. Then, of course, Stark was Admiral Stark. Marshall was the... And, of course, Stark was the chief of the naval operations. General Marshall was the chief of the army. He was in charge of the army. And, of course, Knox was the Secretary of the Navy, and Stimson was the Secretary of War. And he said we were there for about an hour and a half, and the President brought up Japan and the relationships with Japan, and he said that he thought we'd probably be attacked very, very soon, probably by next Monday. Now, this is November 25th, the notation is. So November 25th, 1941, we'll probably be attacked by next Monday because the Japanese are known to have surprise attacks. And then the question was raised as to what we should do. How would we get into the war, manipulate the Japanese to fire the first shot, and do as little damage to ourselves as possible? How would we get into the war, get the Japanese to fire the first shot, and have as little damage done to ourselves as possible? That's what the page says. We have that if any of you want the page out of Henry Stimson's diary. So that was the plan. We were going to get into the war. We weren't going to let the American people know we intended to get into the war. We were going to try to say the Japanese were responsible for everything. And you have to understand that we've been, of course, breaking the Japanese codes and reading all of their messages for some time. We'd broken the purple code, we'd broken the diplomatic code, the military code. We knew all the messages of the Japanese. We'd put an oil embargo on Japan. We'd placed our Pacific fleet, taken it off the Pacific coast and put it at Pearl Harbor so it would be a better target. In fact, Admiral Richardson, who's commander of the Pacific fleet, had quit the Navy over that because he felt that we were setting ourselves up for an attack. And when he told President Clinton that the Navy didn't trust him anymore, why the President relieved him of his command. And I think Richardson, Admiral Richardson, was glad to be out of that position because he didn't want to lead us to a defeat at Pearl Harbor. It was well known, of course, that this was what it was all about. We were simply putting the target out there for the Japanese. Well, then, of course, we began to follow what happened. The Japanese sent a message to their ambassador in Washington, D.C., and it was a 14-part message. The first 13 parts were, of course, intercepted by our Navy on the 6th of December. Now, at that time, we knew that the Japanese fleet was just northwest of Hawaii. We knew, of course, when they were going to attack because of the 14-part message. And the 14-part message, basically, of the first 13 parts were the grievances against the United States and saying there was no solution to them. And so the President was given the decoded message at 9:30 on the evening of December 6th. The military officer who took it to President Roosevelt said the President read the message, looked up and said, "This means war." The President had tried to call Admiral Stark, the Chief of Naval Operations. He was at a operetta. He didn't want to disturb him because he said, the President said, well, he was afraid that the people would be concerned if Admiral Stark was paged from the operetta. So he just did nothing. Admiral Stark called him back after midnight, and that would be early on the morning of December the 7th. And remember, Washington, D.C. is 6 hours ahead of Hawaii time. So, of course, Admiral Stark called him back. They talked about the war message. And then, of course, Admiral Stark should have put everybody on a war alert, and he didn't. He didn't contact the people at Pearl Harbor. Of course, the command in the South Pacific had a decoding machine that specifically kept a decoding machine away from Pearl Harbor. So the people in the South Pacific knew what was happening, but the people at Pearl Harbor did not. Well, of course, then the following morning, the 14th part of the message came through. It was intercepted about 4:30 in the morning. It was decoded and given to President Roosevelt at 9:30 Sunday morning, December 7th. And he read that, and of course, it basically said the Japanese were breaking off the relations with the United States, that the ambassador was to deliver the message to President Roosevelt at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, which would be 7 o'clock at Pearl Harbor time. And, of course, it was a declaration, in essence, a declaration of war. So the President knew we were going to war. He should have, of course, convened his cabinet, told everybody to warn all of our commands that the war was coming. And what did he do? He did nothing. And then, of course, the aide to General George Castle Marshall was chief of the Army. And the only people who could issue the war message were either Admiral Stark, chief of the Naval Operations, or the General Marshall, chief of staff of the Army. And General Marshall's aide, was a Colonel Bracken, and he read the message very early in the morning, and of course he tried to contact General George Captain Marshall. Now, we know the attack is coming, it's just a matter of time. And where's General Marshall? Why, he's horseback riding alone at Fort Myer Park. So, of course, Colonel Bracken sends an aide over, to Fort Myer, and General Marshall calls Colonel Bracken at 10 o'clock. And Colonel Bracken says, I've got this war message. You need to read it. I need authorization to warn the commands. And General Marshall says, don't worry. I'll come right to the office. It's only 10 minutes away. 75 minutes later, At 11:15, he arrives at his office. And he looks at the message. He waits 45 minutes. Now it's 12 o'clock. He, of course, assumes, he says, well, it does mean more. I want you to send a message by radio, Army radio, to all of our bases. Well, the Army radio could reach the South Pacific. It could reach San Francisco. It could reach Panama, but it couldn't reach Pearl Harbor. So they sent the message out. They could have gone by Navy radio. It was available. They could have picked up the telephone, the scrambler telephone, and put the call in by telephone and warned the people at Pearl Harbor. Because if Admiral Kimmel had known what was going to happen, he could have at least got some of his ships to sea, but he could have gotten the planes away from the, being all bunched together. He could have actually got those planes in the air, and they could have intercepted the Japanese squadrons that were coming in, the bombers and the torpedo planes, before they ever got to Pearl Harbor. But, of course, Admiral Kimmel never got the warning. General George Captain Marshall's message was actually sent by Western Union cable. And it arrived half an hour after the attack had begun. It was delivered by a boy on a bicycle at Pearl Harbor. Now, if you think that happened by accident, I think you're sadly mistaken. I think you probably would be a good candidate to sell some stock in the Golden Gate Bridge to. They left those men there to die. 3,000 men were either killed or 3,112 men were either killed or listed as missing that morning. Another 1,200 were wounded that morning at Pearl Harbor. Because, of course, Washington, D.C. refused to warn Pearl Harbor what was coming. And they knew it was coming. And they knew that they did not have a coding machine. They would not know unless Washington informed them. And Washington very intentionally did not warn them and allowed the attack to happen. So what does that have to do with September 11th? Well, there's certain things we know about September 11th. First of all, we know that the CIA briefed the President of the United States, George Bush, on the 6th of August and told him that Al-Qaeda planned to hijack American airliners. Now, we do not know what else was said that morning, because the rest of the information is classified. But we know that, he was briefed that there were going to be a hijacking of American passenger planes with the passengers on them. Now, imagine you were the President of the United States and you knew that information. What would you do? Well, I think that you would probably very seriously consider arming the pilots. What had happened back in 1994 was when we first started getting messages that said that the Islamic terrorists were going to hijack planes and use them as weapons. How do we know that? Well, the testimony of Eleanor Hill that was made that morning, September 18th, and we have that available here at Radio Liberty, and we can't set it out for nothing. You can pull it down off the Internet, or you can get the references to it in my September letter, or, of course, you can get it from Radio Liberty if you need to, if you can't get it any other place. That's Eleanor Hill's testimony. She tells you that starting in 1994, they had information that, of course, the Islamic terrorists were planning on hijacking our planes and using them as weapons. And not only that, she said that they knew that they were targeting the World Trade Center. There was talk about having small planes and filling them full of explosives and crashing into the World Trade Center. And repeatedly, this was one of the possible targets was the World Trade Center. So all of this was known by our intelligence agencies. And if you, of course, have heard what was told the media, oh, we thought the attack was overseas, they knew the attack was going to be in the United States, according to Eleanor Hill. All of the information said it was going to be here. Osama bin Laden was intent upon attacking the United States. So they knew the attack was coming on the United States. So the president is told, and we don't know what else he was told, but he's told that, of course, they are going to hijack American planes. Nothing is said about crashing their buildings, or at least if it was said, that information is classified and there's nothing to conceal. Why is the president concealing it? Well, anyway, of course, then the next thing, what should the president have done at that time? Well, he should have tried to head off the attack, shouldn't he? Would that be the logical thing to do? In July of 2001, just a month beforehand, the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, issued a directive that disarmed all of our pilots. Now, prior to that, pilots could carry weapons if they'd passed certain safety regulations and taken certain courses. And some of the pilots were carrying the weapons, but knowing full well that there is a plan to hijack our planes and, of course, commandeer them for whatever purpose. And, of course, intelligence agencies know that that is going to be for the purpose, of crashing into the buildings. What do? The FAA disarms all of our pilots in July of 2001. We had air marshals on our planes through 1996. The first inference that we were going to use the planes as weapons, the Islamists were going to use the planes as weapons, came in 1994. So in 1996, we phased out the air marshal program so that they could be sure there'd be no armed air marshals on the planes. Then in July, they disarmed all the pilots. Now, if you were the President of the United States and you knew these things, what would you do? Well, the first thing I would have done if I'd been President, I would have, of course, immediately ordered that the airlines arm all the pilots. Had that occurred, why, I suspect that the hijackers never would have, they would have heard this to the media and they never would have put in the attack. The second thing I would have done was order that the cockpit doors of the planes be kept locked at all times, and that I would immediately start reinforcing the doors, because the GAO, the General Administrative Office, had repeatedly said that the doors on the passenger planes should be reinforced. So this was well known. Another president could have called up the National Guard, and he could have, of course, put a couple of armed guardsmen on every plane. And he could have told the American people, of course, there was a threat, and they would have understood and they would have appreciated it. What did he do? August 6th, he knows there's going to be an attack. He does absolutely nothing. And nothing was done. Nothing was done until, of course, after the attack. And then, of course, all the things were suggested needed to be done beforehand were done. And you have to ask yourself, why? What did the president do? Well, as soon as the attack came, they immediately classified all information about prior knowledge. They told government employees not to talk to anybody about what they knew or fear of losing their job. They objected and opposed an independent congressional investigation. They withheld information from the Senate House Select Committee, and they censored the report that the Senate Select Committee put out. What does that suggest to you? Is this another Pearl Harbor? Did they know the attack was coming, or an attack was coming, and not do anything to stop it? Well, if you look at the similarity between what happened at Pearl Harbor, before Pearl Harbor, the United States Navy was monitoring all of the Japanese communications, diplomatic, and they were monitoring their military transmissions. We knew everything the Japanese were doing. But you must remember that NSA, the National Service Security Administration, NSA, was basically monitoring all electronic transmissions throughout the world. They were reading all emails, they were reading all telephone conversations, their computers were reading all faxes and all, everything that went out either by cell phone or by regular telephone. All of those were being monitored by telephone. That was illegal, but they were doing it anyway. They had the English doing it in the United States, and we were doing it over in England, and they were doing it throughout the world, and we were monitoring what the terrorists were saying, and we were intercepting things, the terrorist conversations, talking in Time magazine. She said, the big one's about to happen. It's going to be in a couple of days. And Osama bin Laden is talking to his mother and says, you won't hear from me for some time. Something big is going to happen in 2 days. They knew all of these things. And what did they do? Absolutely nothing. And so we were monitoring all of the terrorists. Now, we not only were monitoring all the terrorists throughout the world, we were monitoring the terrorists here in the United States. Have you ever wondered why there have been no terrorist attacks on the United States since 9/11, other than the anthrax attack, and that probably didn't come from the terrorists, because Dick Cheney knew that was coming. He started on Cipro the very day of the attack, he and his staff there at the White House, and you wouldn't go on Cipro unless you knew the attack was coming or you were very suspicious the attack was coming. So the anthrax attack probably was not from the terrorists. So let's, of course, then look at the what happened from October of the year 2001 until right now. There have been no significant attacks in the United States, and yet we know that there were dozens of terrorist cells here in the United States of Al-Qaeda terrorists who'd been in training camps. And if you haven't seen that video a jihad in America by Stephen Emerson Unit to get it, and understand there were terror cells all over the United States. What happened to them? Why, they were all arrested on the first 2 days after the 9/11. I remember they arrested 1,200 Islamic Muslim people. Now, you might say, well, a lot of them were supposedly here illegally on immigration charges. Well, if they're in immigration charges, send them out of the country. You don't keep them locked up for 2 years. And, of course, we have 6 million Muslims in America. Why did they pick out just 1,200 of them? Because a lot of the other Muslims are here illegally in a violation of immigration. And the reason is that these were the Islamic terrorists who were here, of course, to commit terrorist acts in America. And they didn't want them committing terrorist acts, so they arrested them all. But we can't tell the American people that, because that means we knew ahead of time exactly who the terrorists were. And those of you who have heard or read Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, and if you haven't read it, you should. You can get it down off the web. She testified before the Senate House Select Committee on Intelligence on the 18th of September. That's Kristen Breitweiser. Or you can go to my website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And pull down my October 2000 newsletter, and it's there. That's the October 2000 newsletter. It's her testimony. And she points out that, according to the New York Times, within 2 hours of the attack, the FBI was at the restaurants where the terrorists ate, at the neighborhoods where they lived, or where some of them lived, and at the flight schools where they trained. Now, imagine that it's really true. We had no idea who these terrorists were. We had no idea that they were going to attack us. But within 2 hours, we were at the restaurants where they ate, some of them ate, at the neighborhoods where some of them lived, at the flight schools where they trained. Do you honestly believe that? And, of course, I hope you don't. I hope you begin to think and understand they knew who the terrorists were ahead of time. They knew who all the other terrorists in the United States were, because those are the 1,200 people they arrested, and that's why we haven't had any other terrorist attacks. And if you listen to what John Ashcroft says, the Attorney General says very carefully, he's saying we need these laws. We need the Patriot laws. If we didn't have those in place, we couldn't be holding a lot of these people. And we can't release their names because we don't want Osama bin Laden to know who we're holding. Do you honestly believe that? I mean, do you really think that we're interested with Osama bin Laden knows who we're holding? You don't think he already knows who we're holding? They don't want the American people to know that we knew who the terrorists were ahead of time. And that's why we haven't had any terrorist attacks. Now, our intelligence agencies are extremely efficient. They try to give you the idea of, oh, these bumbling idiots. Oh, my goodness, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't talk to one another. Of course they talked to one another. They were talking to one another all the time. They just don't want you to know that they were talking to one another and that they knew exactly what was going to happen and that the terrorist attack was planned. And to read Eleanor Hill's testimony, although she says that there was no specific information on the exact date or the exact target, but they certainly had talked about hitting the World Trade Center with planes and loaded with explosives or with commercial airliners. So they knew this was certainly a possibility. So then, of course, you need then to read Mindy Kleinberg's testimony, and that's going to be our September newsletter. And she simply points out what happened on that morning, that Tuesday morning. And, of course, here is the man who is the acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Meyer. And what is he doing? We're on maximum alert. We're expecting an attack at any time. He sees on television that a plane has hit North Tower, and he thinks, oh, it's probably just a small plane. A fellow probably lost his way, and he goes into a meeting, and he stays there for the next 2 hours and can't be reached. So nobody's really in charge of the military. And then, of course, where is Donald Rumsfeld, who is, of course, the Secretary of Defense? Well, he's in his office in the Pentagon. And, they hit the first building, they hit the second building, and he stays in his office in the Pentagon. And then, of course, when the plane swoops around, it flies a big circle around the Pentagon and comes into an area where, fortunately, there aren't too many people, area that's being renovated, and crashes in there, and then Donald Rumsfeld gets up from his desk and goes over to the area to help the victims. Now, is this quite logical that the Secretary of Defense We know we're on full alert. We know we're about to be attacked. They've already hit two of our towers, and he's still staying at his desk. They haven't convened a meeting. They haven't gotten the military together. They haven't put planes in the air. Well, they did put some planes in the air. They brought them in from Langley at subsonic speed, so they arrived after the attack. There are various reports. Either they came in from Langley or they came in from Cape Cod. We don't know. But we do know that they sent planes in that were not to be there before the plane hit the Pentagon. That's for certain. And whether they came from Cape Cod or they came from Langley, if they were flying at supersonic speed, they certainly would have been there in plenty of time. So why were there no planes in the air to guard the Pentagon or to guard the South Tower? Why were there no fighter planes in the air that morning? Remember, there were no fighter planes in the air at Pearl Harbor because they were all bunched up for a suicide alert. And, of course, there were no planes, fighter planes, in the air that morning to protect America when they knew the attack was coming. Did they know the date? Yes, because somebody had warned Willie Brown the night before, and then you can see the CIA influence in covering that information up. And then, of course, my friend, Dr. Garth Nicholson, who I believe to be an honest man, told me that he was told by intelligence agencies, and he can't reveal their name, that the attack was coming on the 11th of September. It was going to hit the Pentagon. He had already sent the information out to people in the Defense Intelligence Agency. David Shippers was told there would be an attack about that time, although the exact date was uncertain. He was told it would be in Lower Manhattan. If you've read Dr. Dennis Cuddy's little book, September 11th, Prior Knowledge, everybody in New York at the schools there, the kids are even bringing their cameras to school so they could take pictures of the Twin Towers when they were hit on that morning. Everybody knew the exact date it was going to occur, but our intelligence agencies didn't know. Do you really believe that? Well, let's go to Nathan calling in here from Contra Costa. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Hi. Good evening, Dr.
And our telephone number, incidentally, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's good to be with you and each and every single one of you again. I'll tell you the honest truth. You know, I don't really have enough facts that I can really comment intelligently on what you're talking about. I have my own ideas, and they're rather complicated, but, you know, I should save it for another time. I think what I have is I have a point that runs parallel to the whole September 11th discussion that will hopefully put it into a broad perspective. There's another September 11th that is discussed very, very little that should be discussed a lot more, and I'm not talking about September 11th, 2001.
Are you talking about September 11th, the year of, pardon me, let's see, would it be 1900? Pardon me, 1990?
We'll take it after the break. What I mean.
Because on September 11th, 1990, George Bush, President George Herbert Walker Bush, gave a talk in which he talked about the New World Order and how we had to have a New World Order. We'll be right back. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. If you agree, disagree, that's what talk radio is all about. But right now, we have Nathan, and he wants to talk about another September 11th. Did I see your thunder there?
Well, no, it's interesting. You know, the number 11 years, and, you know, there are these things you hear about the number 11, and I don't want to get into it because numerology can be a snare that takes people away from God, and maybe it's inappropriate. No, I actually was going to talk about another September 11th. I was going to talk about September 11th, 1973. This was September 11th in Chile when factions or forces within our own government cooperated with a coup that overthrew the elected government in Chile and imposed a dictatorship. Now, obviously, it's a complicated story because there were communists involved, and I don't want to oversimplify or make it some sort of type of simplistic tale, but it was, let's face it, it was an act of the overthrow of an elected government, and guess what? Thousands of people were killed. You know, we have to look at this in perspective. We are, our lives here are fragile, and we are subject to the events and the misfortunes of the world, including the judgments of God. I'm not saying what happened on September 11th was a direct judgment of God for that. I'm not suggesting that. But we have to look at things in a very broad perspective. And I would say this both to those who believe that there was prior warning or and or conspiracy, and to those who don't. I think that both need to understand, need to wake up and need to repent and understand that God does judge nations, and that events that happen in the world are sometimes, in fact, events that happen in the world are ordained or at least allowed by God to occur. And, you know, some of you might say that that's not fair. Some of you might say that how dare I have that perspective on this type of event, to which I would say, now I'm not minimizing the tragedy or the loss that happened on September 11th, 2001, but I think that when we reflect on it, we should also reflect on September 11th, 1973, and I think we should reflect on that tragedy and that loss too, and yet how casually it is that we often dismiss tragedies and misfortunes elsewhere in the world, and I'm not just talking about that one, I'm talking about ones that we barely hear about on the news because nobody cares. I think there was a great poet who once said, no man is an island, and that, you know, we're all connected, we're all, you know, God created all of us the children of one Father, and we're all connected, and I leave that thought to you, that ultimately, in the end, it's not about American lives, it's not about Chilean lives, it's about human lives, and that's how it seems to me. I hope that you all have a good High Holy Days, and please fast and repent on this Yom Kippur. Thank you.
All right, fine. Well, thank you very much. Of course, that statement you made concludes talking about no man is an island, but not for whom the bell tolls, for it tolls for thee. That's the concluding remarks in that. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful quotation. So our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there listening, and I'd like to know what you think about what we've talked about on September 11th, the attack. Certainly, I would think that the government knew it was coming. There was no question they knew it was coming. And what measures did they take to protect the American people? Well, we, of course, know that, of course, somebody bought up the seats on those planes, because the planes taken together would have carried well over 1,000 people, and there were only about 250 people on the four airplanes. So somebody very kindly bought up a lot of the seats on those planes that were completely empty, because usually flights that time of morning are quite well filled. And there's, do you honestly believe that Osama bin Laden bought up tickets on those planes so that so many Americans wouldn't be killed? And then, of course, we know that people were shorting American Airlines and United Airlines stock, both on the Chicago Exchange and in the European Exchange. In fact, we have articles from the head of the central bank over in Germany and France talking about how they had to have prior knowledge because they were shorting J.P. Morgan Company, and they were shorting American Airlines, United Airlines, and some of the insurance companies that were, of course, insuring the World Trade Center. So, of course, there was obviously prior knowledge, and yet isn't it fascinating we have never heard who it was who sold those shorts? Well, of course, if you go to Alex Jones' website, I believe, Infowars.com, prior knowledge, you'll find references to the fact that there were ties to the CIA. Somebody named Kronberg, as I remember, associated with the CIA, was associated with a bank that was doing a lot of the shorting of United Airlines and American Airlines stock. Now, why don't we ever hear anything about that? Isn't anybody interested in who was shorting ahead of time? And then those of you who heard our last hour will remember that I mentioned the name of General Mohammad Ahmed, who was head of the Pakistani ISI. And, of course, General Muhammad Ahmed had sent $100,000 to Muhammad Atta, who led this whole thing, and the Indian government had actually come up with that information, and they, of course, according to our guest, Paul Sperry, they wanted America to go in with them against Pakistan, which was really behind this whole thing. The Taliban had come out of Pakistan, the Islamic terrorist movement was funded by Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. But what everybody has missed, it was also funded by our CIA. And to get the background on that, we have a wonderful book. It's called Daughters for Terror. It was written 2 years before the September 11th attack by a Swiss journalist who spent 4 years traveling throughout Europe and the Near East, talking to people and trying to find out who was really behind this whole Islamic terrorist movement. And he came up with the conclusion, as it was, of course, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, ISI, Pakistani intelligence. But then if you listen to the last hour, you'll remember that the Pakistani intelligence and the CIA were very, very close. And Muhammad Ahmed was very, very close to the American CIA. So he's funding Muhammad Atta, and who leads the attack. There's something wrong with this whole picture. You know, the American people are not being told the whole truth behind it. In fact, General Muhammad Ahmed was actually in Washington, D.C. a week before the September 11th attack, and he was meeting with high government officials on that morning. Now, have you read about that in the local newspaper? That's totally, things like this are totally blacked out, because there are certain things the American people aren't supposed to know. If you want to verify what I'm saying, go to Infowars.com, look in the prior knowledge section, and of course go down to these articles out of the India Times. And there were two or three publications, I think Southeast Asia Times, carried almost the identical story about the Pakistani intelligence ISI chief, General Muhammad Ahmed, funding the Islamic terrorist attack. So, you know, we're not getting the truth, and Saudi Arabia was involved in this. And why aren't we punishing these people in Pakistan and in Saudi Arabia who funded al-Qaeda? There's no question that Saudi Arabia funded al-Qaeda. And this prince, this good friend of George Bush's, Prince Bandar, it was his wife who gave $100,000 to the two people who gave it to the terrorist himself, who were living in San Diego with the FBI informants. They were living with the FBI informants. And, of course, the CIA knew who these men were. They'd heard them talking about bombing the coal over in Malaysia. And, of course, they allowed them to come into the United States. I mean, sure, they could put them on a watch list and cut them out. They could have put them on a watch list for our planes. You knew they had a watch list for our planes. And there's certain people who weren't allowed on the planes. You know, in fact, my friend David Wagner, whenever he tries to fly, he's on that list, and they always take him aside and go through all of his baggage and give him a very bad time whenever he's going to fly in the United States, both before 9/11 and since then. Barrett Schoss, who's a frequent guest here, was on that terrorist list until, of course, she started talking about it on her website and on her radio programs, and they took her off the terrorist list. But they did have a watch list on our airlines. And, of course, what happened is 9 of the terrorists were stopped that morning. Now, remember, September 11th, we were on maximum alert. They knew the attack was coming. So why did they let these people on with box cutters? Box cutters are not something you're supposed to take onto a plane. And these were people who were on the watch list. You'd think they would have, searched them very carefully and let them take on the, they could take on pepper spray. They were allowed to take on pepper spray. They were allowed to take on their box cutters. In fact, at least according to one report, one of them had a gun. How could that possibly have happened on that morning on September 11th? And yet it did. And, of course, if you read Christian Breitweiser's testimony, you'll find out that the government actually knew exactly what the three of these terrorists were talking about on a cell phone conversation a week before the attack. How could they know what they were talking about in a cell phone conversation a week before the attack if they didn't know who the terrorists were? And you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're not being told the truth. Now, this is all about a war that was planned long before September 11th. And you know, Paul Sperry has a lot of great information, but those of you who are regular listeners to Radio Liberty know that the Project for the New American Century, a little front group for the Council on Foreign Relations, made up of 25 men, 17 of whom came from the Council on Foreign Relations, began plotting back in the early spring of 1997 on how to take us into a war with Iraq. In June of 1997, they published their Statement of Principles, and you can go to their website at newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org, www.newamericancentury.org, and you can actually pull down their website there, and first you can get their information off of it and find out that in June of they published a Statement of Principles calling for a new international order that would benefit our prophet and our principles, whatever principles they might be talking about. And it was then, of course, in 1998, where these people sent a letter to President Clinton calling for a war with Iraq. They were calling for a war with Iraq in 1998. Who were these people? John Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz. By 1998, it was John Bolton, who was the Undersecretary of State, and of course, you go right on down the line of, you find these people, a columnist, Gary Bauer, and of course, he sends emails to me all the time, and just really just gushing over the war and how wonderful the war is, but he never mentions part of this little conspiracy, and it was a conspiracy, to change American foreign policy to get us into a war in the Middle East. And they were plotting this back in 1998. In fact, of course, Ted Koppel commented on this, when he interviewed William Crystal in March of this year. And of course, he talked about this was a plan for world domination by these people. And of course, it was planned long before George Bush became the president. And simply the 9/11 gave them the opportunity to implement the plan that they had all along. And of course, he said, never since Mein Kampf has anybody said exactly what they were going to do as clearly as this PNAC group, and that's exactly true. They began plotting before George Bush was ever president on getting us into a war with Iraq, but they had to have a justification. They had to have some means of getting the American people to go along with the war. How are you going to get them to go along with the war? Well, in September of 2000, just 12 months before the September 11th, 2001 attack, why, first, this group, PNAC, published something called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and you'll find it there at their website at newamericancentury.org. And on page 51 of that, they talk about transforming our military policy and how, you know, we need to transform our military policy, but it's going to be very difficult unless, of course, there is a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. And, of course, pardon me, it was a new Pearl Harbor, a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. That was their words just a year before, 12 months before the new Pearl Harbor occurred. And the similarity between what happened at Pearl Harbor in 1941 and what happened just 60 years later in the year 2001 is really very, very striking. And you need, of course, to remember that, of course, the American Navy was reading all of the Japanese intercepts, and we were reading all of the terrorist emails and faxes, and we knew who the terrorists were throughout the world. In fact, as of the present time, we've actually captured or killed two-thirds of all the leaders of Al-Qaeda. Now, that's remarkable. We can't do that with the mafia here in the United States, but we've done that with Al-Qaeda because the full force of American intelligence for the last 2 years has been centered on that, except for we're not really trying to get bin Laden. In fact, we've never tried to get bin Laden. I mean, there were time and time again in 96 when the Saudis tried to turn them over to us, and we wouldn't take them. And finally, these people in the Sudan, and then, of course, they offered them to Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia wouldn't take them. Why? Because bin Laden was the best enemy our money could buy. We needed an enemy, and he was the ideal one. But during the 1997, 98, 99, when he was in Afghanistan, we had time after time after time after time had the opportunity to take him out. We knew exactly where he was. And there was always a reason why we couldn't do it. Oh, it wouldn't work. The CIA, when we had plans ready to go, the CIA said you can't do it. There was always a reason why. Because we never wanted to get bin Laden. When the Afghan war was underway, and you remember, of course, the Afghans offered to send bin Laden out of the country. They offered, of course, to send him to a neutral country where we could try him. They even said they'd turn him over to us if we just show the evidence that he was involved. And he wasn't involved. One of his lieutenants was, but bin Laden didn't plan the attack. He wasn't, not that, that wasn't his job. He was to be the spiritual head of this whole movement, and we made him the spiritual head because somebody killed Azam, a man named Azam, in 1989, and then, of course, we brought, we gave Sheikh Omar Rahman a visa to come to the United States. He was the second man in command of this whole World Islamic Terrorist Movement, and, of course, he was a terrorist, and we gave him a visa to come to the United States. We infiltrated his movement with an FBI informant, and then we arrested him for preaching international terrorism. Of course, he was preaching international terrorism. That's why he was arrested in Egypt, and we got him out of prison there, brought him to America, and put him in prison here, where he can't communicate with anybody at all. And that, of course, with Azam out of the way and Rahman out of the way, who do you think the leader of the World Islamic Terrorist is, movement is? Who is the most revered man in Islam today? His name is Osama bin Laden. We have a wonderful article we got on the Washington Times during the Afghan war. And it was an article that was saying, and if any of you want this article, we have it, that because the United States is not trying to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. A highly placed official in the Defense Department was quoted as saying, and they didn't give his name, of course, that our policy is not Osama bin Laden first, it's Osama bin Laden last. Because if we captured or killed Osama bin Laden, how would we justify continuing the war in Afghanistan? And that's what it was all about. It was about the war in Afghanistan. It was about getting rid of the Taliban. It wasn't about getting rid of Osama bin Laden. And then, of course, in the year 2001, when, of course, the Northern Alliance fighters were closing in on what they thought was Osama bin Laden and a band of Al-Qaeda, I don't know how many there were, 500 or so of them, and they were just about ready to exterminate them. And we have the article, if any of you want to check this out, and in comes a fleet of black helicopters and picks them all up and whisks them away. Gee, I didn't know Osama bin Laden had a fleet of black helicopters, did you? I wonder where he's been hiding them all this time. Or do you think those might have been CIA helicopters that picked them up and spirited them away? Do you think that maybe we're actually protecting Osama bin Laden? He's the best enemy that money could buy. Ladies and gentlemen, go back and read the book. It's called 1984. It's a classic. And there's a man there who is the enemy of Big Brother. His name was Emmanuel Goldstein. And Emmanuel Goldstein, of course, if you ever wanted to get an emotional response from the people who lived in Big Brother's territory, well, you put a picture of Emmanuel Goldstein up on the screen, and of course everybody would boo, and of course kids were to hate Emmanuel Goldstein. He is, of course, the enemy of Big Brother. And who is the enemy of our president? Well, his name is Osama bin Laden. And, of course, I don't even know if he's alive or dead. I suspect he's alive, but I don't know that. We don't know anything other than what we read in the newspaper, and what we read in the newspaper is what they want us to think and believe. And, of course, bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, and, of course, you remember, we allowed al-Zawahiri to come here in 1995. He was a known terrorist. We allowed him to tour the United States. And, of course, you collect money for Osama bin Laden. Why would we do that? Because in 1994, of course, he had orchestrated the Black Hawk Down scenario where they killed 18 Americans in Somalia. You would think that we would have wanted to get Osama bin Laden, the man who planned the attack on the American forces in Somalia. That's all covered in the book called Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War Against America, by Joseph Bedansky. And if you haven't got the book, you need to get it from Radio Liberty. We're just about out of time. If any of you out there would like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'll be back in just a moment. understand here. You know, there's so many unanswered questions out there. For instance, the CIA worked with Osama bin Laden all during the 1980s. Everybody knows that. The American government financed the Taliban back in 1994, and of course we helped them take over the country, and then of course they began, their rather ruthless treatment of women and imposition of Sharia law, but we continued financing them. In fact, as of September of the year 2001, we were the largest single financier of the Taliban in the entire world. We were financing the Taliban despite the fact they were treating women badly and imposing Sharia law on this. This entire corrupt regime was being financed with your foreign aid money. But don't feel bad. Of course, who do you think is providing food and oil and other things for the dictator of North Korea? Why, we are, because, of course, we figure that if we don't give him food and oil, why, of course, he won't like us, or he won't negotiate with us, or no, we're creating the best enemy money can buy, and you have to understand that is a constant pattern. We can always justify giving financial aid to our enemies, but that's just as we did with Adolf Hitler, building him up before the Second World War, creating the best enemy money can buy, just as we did with the communists all during the Cold War, and really starting back in 1918, but then you need to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it and find out that Lenin was totally subservient to, of course, a man named Bruce Lockhart, who had been set by Lord Milner, who was very, very close to international finance in England, and, of course, the representative of the Federal Reserve Board, Frederick Boyce Thompson, as I remember, this gentleman was there. And, of course, Bruce Lockhart and the representative of the Federal Reserve Board were in all the top communist meetings. Lenin would consult with them before he made any major decision. And Bruce Lockhart obviously wasn't very smart. In his book, Imperial Agent, he says he just never understood why, Lenin was always so subservient to him and to this fellow from the United States when he was a communist and they were supposedly representing the wicked capitalists. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and look that up, and of course get the references, and we take extensive quotations out of Bruce Lockhart's book, but of course you can get the book and read it, and you begin to realize nothing as it appears to be, because behind everything going on today are powerful, powerful spiritual forces, and once you understand that, then everything begins to make sense. If you're looking at things logically, nothing makes sense. We are going to be in Iraq for a good long while. I heard, of course, General Colin Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell, saying yesterday we're only going to be in Iraq until we can get stability there and get democratic elections. We're not going to get stability there. We're not going to get democratic elections. We are now sending over civilian administrators, thousands of them, with five-year contracts, and they're going to be there at least 5 years. We are going to remake this country. We're going to give them a new health care program. We're going to redo their schools. We're going to use this as an example of how we can change the outlook of Muslims and change how what they think and believe. And I don't think it's going to work because, of course, the Islamists, I have a whole different world outlook. What we're going to do is lose an awful lot of boys over there. There was a fascinating article in the San Jose Mercury I just was reading this morning where a San Jose Mercury reporter actually went and talked to some of the guerrilla fighters who are killing our boys. And, of course, they're killing our boys because we have invaded their country. These are not al-Qaeda. They're people from Iraq, and, of course, they're angry with us because we've killed their neighbors. We've killed their brothers and sisters. And, of course, they're going to kill us, and they're going to continue fighting and killing us until we leave. And there is no way we're going to subdue them, no matter how hard we try, unless we kill almost every Muslim in Iraq, and this is the tragedy of the situation we've got ourselves into, and we know this is true. We're not planning on pulling out at all. We're planning on stationing our troops there permanently, and we have to have an excuse. And Islamic fighters are coming from all over the world into Iraq. Why? Because we are on holy land. These people may have hated Saddam Hussein, we are on their land. We are on Muslim land. And, of course, this is like the Crusades of old, where Muslims would come throughout the world, and these are people who look at the world differently than you and I. The only way they can be sure to get to paradise is to die killing infidels, to die in jihad. And, of course, as the Islamic fundamentalist religion expands, and it is expanding, why more and more people are going to come to Iraq, and more Americans are going to die. And, of course, this is exactly what we knew was going to happen. Our leaders are not stupid. Say what you will about them. They're not stupid. They may be diabolical, but they're not stupid. And the tragedy is there are going to be more and more flag-draped coffins coming home. There are going to be more and more boys coming home without arms and legs. More and more boys are going to have mental disorders for the rest of their life because of the trauma that they've been through. And who's going to be to blame? It's got to be the good people of America who haven't been willing to challenge to find out if we're right or wrong. Because if we're right, then you need to get involved. How are you going to get involved? You're going to become informed. You're going to inform others. You're going to start our 10-point program. First of all, a personal relationship with our Lord. Being close to God is the only thing that's going to get you through this battle. And then understanding our Constitution, and that's where the Institute of the Constitution comes in. And then, of course, understanding who the bad guys are and what their goals and objectives are. And understanding we're involved in a spiritual battle, of being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And if we don't get this thing straightened out, there is going to be a nuclear attack on America that will rain fire and brimstone on this country, unimaginable. There are going to be terrible things happening to America, and you're going to lose your country, you're going to lose your family, you're going to lose your freedom. Join the Radio Liberty family. Help us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. And so we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and working with us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for our leaders and to pray for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because if we don't have revival in America, if you honestly believe that God would ever bless America again, watch television. Look at the poverty we have there. We've got PAX television. You should be watching PAX. But don't watch these vile, vile programs put out there that corrupt our youth and corrupt our adults and corrupt our sense of right and wrong. And of course, lastly, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be back again. Dr. Stanford Nigel. May the Lord be with you.